From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Tonight, the Rhythm and Blues Foundation holds its 10th annual award ceremonies. On today's Fresh Air, we'll meet one of the award winners, guitarist Mickey Baker. He's being honored for his work as a sideman on hundreds of records from the 50s and 60s. He was also half of the duo Mickey and Sylvia. Also, what if God created Adam and Steve instead of Adam and Eve? We talk with writer Paul Rudnick about his latest play, The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told, A Gay Look at the Garden of Eden. TV critic David Bianculli previews NBC's Alice in Wonderland, and Lord Schwartz reviews art shows by two 17th century painters, Caravaggio and de Hoek. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Well, this is the big music awards week. The Grammys were last night. Tonight is the Rhythm and Blues Foundation award ceremony. Smokey Robinson will MC. The Lifetime Achievement Award will go to John Lee Hooker. One of the Pioneer Awards will go to guitarist Mickey Baker, who is being honored for his work on hundreds of recording sessions in the 50s and 60s as a sideman. Recordings by such performers as Laverne Baker, Ruth Brown, The Coasters, The Drifters, Screamin' Jay Hawkins, and Ivory Joe Hunter. Mickey Baker was also half of the duo Mickey and Sylvia, which had the 1957 hit Love is Strange. He's lived in France since the early 60s. Before we meet him, let's hear him with Ray Charles on this 1953 recording of Losing Hand.
I thought I'd be your king, baby. Yes, and you could be my queen. I thought I'd be your king, baby. But you used me for your joker, 'cause I thought your deal was clean.
Was this rehearsed at all? Had you worked out with Ray Charles the interplay between his piano and your guitar?
No. Those days, you go in the studio, you listen to the music, and you start recording. Of course, they had charts, and you look, but everything was done from the soul, from the heart, you know what I mean? The charts didn't mean anything. Whatever, what you hear coming out on a record, none of that was written on a chart, you know what I mean? But I was a specialist in that sort of stuff. I really analyzed all of those types of blues playing and whatnot, and that's how I became a studio musician, because I took it very seriously playing that music, you know? And they knew that if Mickey Baker was playing the guitar, he would find something to do that would fit in with the mood of the music. That's about the best I can say of it.
Would you choose one of the Atlantic recording sessions that you're featured on that you particularly like?
One song that was nice was Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean by Ruth Brown. It starts off with the guitar. And what I was playing on the guitar was the type of guitar that everybody wanted to hear at that time, you know. And I used that type of guitar playing on that I used on that song, Mama, He Treats Your Daughter Mean. Many guitar record sessions basically the same. It's the introduction that's what makes it nice. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
What year it was, I don't know. Maybe 54, I think.
Actually, I just looked it up. It was recorded in 1952.
It was?
Yeah, and let's see. You're featured on guitar. Connie Kay from the Modern Jazz Quartet is featured on drums. He did a lot of session work for Rhythm and Blues Records, didn't he?
Connie was... in those days, Connie had a set of drums that were really comical. You know, he was... Well, everybody was starting off in those days, you know. Nobody had anything, you know. And they were just happy to be musicians. And I think that's what made the music go so well. Nobody really knew what they were doing in those days, but they did it so well. You know, it was all done alive in a studio within 3 or 4 hours, 4 sides, you know what I mean? And today, to do 3 or 4 sides on an album, it takes these guys a month with all kinds of recording. But it was all done live. If you had singers, the singers were there, saxophones, everything was there at one time.
Why don't we hear Ruth Brown's 1952 recording of Mama, He Treats Her Daughter Mean with my guest Mickey Baker, featured on guitar.
Mean. Mama, he
Town, recorded in 1952. My guest, Mickey Baker, featured on guitar. And he is being awarded a Pioneer Award from the Rhythm and Blues Foundation for the hundreds of recording sessions that he worked on in the 1950s and 60s. Now, this was a period when usually if there was an instrumental break on a rhythm and blues record, it was like a honking saxophone break. Did you have to kind of fight for room for the guitar because the saxophones were so prominently featured?
Oh, no. Well, the guitar was, in those days, the type of guitar that you're playing, you could always fill in behind the saxophone while he's doing his solo, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in the way, they chose who's going to play the solo. You know, they said, well, we're in a sax solo here, a guitar solo here, et cetera. It was all worked out. It was always worked out who was going to do what solo here, even if it's a half of a chorus, you know what I mean? It was all done, I used to say, lipperaneously, you know.
You say it?
Lipperaneously. you know, like a extemporaneous, lipperaneously. We'd just talk. Once we know the pattern of the song, we know how we're going to. Once you know that the guitar, what kind of rhythm the guitar is going to play in the background, what the piano is going to play in the background, and what the saxophone is supposed to be playing in there. Right? It's what it's like. The thing starts up, doom 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 doom. The guitar goes jingling, 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 and the sax go whoa. You know, it's like that. And they all work themselves out together. You know, anyway, it was a natural for the musician to do. They didn't do that with any musician. They had very well chosen musician to do that. You know, you couldn't get that from any musician.
Did you usually like the records that you made? Did you usually like the groups that you were recording with? You know, the vocal groups.
It was always fun. You felt that you were doing something great. You know, making hit records. Well, you were young, and you would think you can hear yourself playing on a record. You know, that nobody knew who you were on the record, but they'd like the guitar solo, and you would say, "See, it makes you feel good that you're doing something like that." You know, we were very proud of what we were doing, no matter who we were recording with. You know.
Well, you just made a good point there, which is that the session men were really pretty anonymous. I mean, now maybe on a reissue it'll say who the musicians were on a date, but when the records came out in their own time, it would give the name of the group or the lead singer. But that was it. You wouldn't be mentioned as the guitarist. Did you feel bad about that?
No, you have to realize that. You're working as a studio. I was working as a studio musician, and I would do three or four record sessions a day.
Mm-hmm.
And in a week's time, there was no week that went by that I didn't do at least 15 or 20 record sessions. You know, and who cared? You made the money that you wanted. I was at that one point in those days in the 50s, because this is in the 50s we're talking about now. I was making like $400 or $500 a week very easily. You know. Can you imagine? In those days, $400 or $500 a week was like unheard of, you know?
Let me play the Shirelles hit, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow? And the first thing you hear on this record is your guitar. Do you have any memories of this session?
No, I think I did something very different on the guitar, though, something that had never been done before, but I can't remember what it was. They asked me to do, because I was always be so proud. Mickey, you do this, you do this. What can you do with this? And I'd stick my chest out, you know, after all, I was 25 years old, something, you know. Stick my chest out, and I can do this, and I can do it. But you must remember something else. I wasn't actually this type of a guitarist from my roots. I was a jazz musician, so I could do a lot more things with a guitar than an ordinary blues musician can do. You get the idea? And so I'd come up with ideas, and I think there was something with a lot of one of my ching-a-ling guitar things, you know what I mean?
Well, why don't we play the opening for you, and that'll refresh your memory. This is the Shirelles, Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow?
That's like I said, it's a ching-a-ling guitar. Ching-a-ling, tink, tink. You're playing arpeggios on the guitar, you know. Ching-a-ling, tink, 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 ching-a-ling, tink, tink, you know, ching-a-ling.
Very, very twangy.
Uh-huh. Oh, that in those days, that's what they loved. Now they hear the guitars just piercing the guitar today, you know. Just a real. In fact, the way they do it today, they've got boxes to do that. You know, they got a box to do the guitar this way, a box to do that. I think on that guitar that you were hearing there, there was a tremolo on the amplifier, just slightly tremolo effect on the amplifier to give that chick and give that waving sort of a sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on that guitar. But nowadays they have so many different types of boxes they can put on the. You didn't have all of those gimmicks. In fact, you didn't have anything in those days. It was all that's at the time when they were creating these ideas. You get the idea?
My guest is guitarist Mickey Baker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest, guitarist Mickey Baker, is getting a Rhythm and Blues Foundation Award tonight for his work as a sideman on hundreds of recordings from the 50s and 60s. Now, I want to play something different from what we've been hearing, and this is a recording in which I'm not sure if you're the leader on this or not, but it's an instrumental recording, and so it's not a question of being, a studio musician for a vocal group. The Bear Family label has reissued a lot of your instrumental tracks, and this is from 1955. And it's the title track of this reissue. It's called Rock with a Sock. And it features you on guitar, Jimmy Lewis bass, Dave Specs Bailey on drums, Ernest Hayes piano, Warren Lucky on tenor. Now, what do you remember about this?
Rock with a Sock was one of my songs that I recorded at Rainbow Records back in the days of Alan Freed, you know?
Uh-huh.
Because I wanted to name that song Who Freed Alan? And Alan Freed said, no, you're not going to put that name on that around the record. So we changed the name to Rock with a Sock, you know.
Why don't we hear your 1955 recording of Rock with a Sock? This is a tune by my guest, Mickey Baker, who's featured on guitar. Guitarist Mickey Baker recorded in 1955 the title track from a reissue called Rock with a Sock, and Mickey Baker is getting a Pioneer Award from the Rhythm and Blues Foundation for his work on literally hundreds of recording sessions through the 50s and 60s. Now, you were not only a session guitarist, you had your own group for a while, Mickey and Sylvia, whose biggest hit was Love is Strange. How did you end up forming that group?
Well, it's... like I was saying, it was Alan Freed was the popular man in those days, and I was working doing Alan Freed shows as a guitarist in the band, you know, and we'd come out, we'd do our numbers and whatnot. And Sylvia was actually at one time a guitar student of mine. She was also a singer. She had been making records. She had made records as a singer, called it Little Sylvia, you know. And she came to me when I was on an Alan Freed show. I think it was the first Alan Freed show. The rock and roll show, the very first rock and roll show that it was done ever. And Sylvia asked me if I could if I could help her get back in show business. It was simple as all of that. And I says, yeah, because at the time there was Mary Ford and Les Paul, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And Mary Ford and Les Paul, like Les Paul had all of those tape recorders. The music was very nice, but they couldn't perform it on stage.
Because he did a lot of tape manipulation with his recordings.
Yeah, it was all re-recorded. What they do today, he was a master of that way back there then, you know what I mean? So I said, why don't we take the two guitars and we'll figure out a way to make Mickey and Silver and do it on stage. But I want you to know that this was all done as a joke. I never did think that Mickey and Silver would really become so big, you know. But I figured it would be a good idea to try it. It's something that's never been done. But at the time, I was a very busy musician. I was making a lot of money. And to start this Mickey and Sylvia thing going, I had to give up a lot of things to do it. Because I had to go out on little gigs, places with her, trying to make her play the guitar, because she'd never played the guitar on stage. It took time to do that, you know.
So to you, the whole Mickey and Sylvia act was something of a nuisance?
No, it was a joke. I didn't know there was going to be. Well, no, it was like a Frankenstein monster. Let's put it like that. It all of a sudden, the monster choked me to death. I packed up and left the country after that. I didn't want to be bothered with any of that stuff. And that Mickey and Sylvia cut my... I made a lot of... No, don't get me wrong. I made a pile of money with that, you know. But I was no longer a musician. I was Mickey of Mickey and Silver. I didn't like that too much, you know.
Well, in spite of it, let's hear Love is Strange. It's a great record. Baker of Mickey and Sylvia. Was that the Sylvia who owned Sugar Hill Records?
Yeah, she became very popular. She was a fantastic, she had a fantastic imagination. She was
like one of the mothers of rap music. I mean, her label Sugar Hill is like the first big
the first rap record label. That we ever made. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
so were you kind of proud to be kind of affiliated with that?
Well, you know, actually, we lost contact with one another, but actually, that song, Love is Strange, you know, it was her inspiration that made me record that song in the first place. We had to work it out in a way, but I didn't want to be bothered with it one way or the other, you know. But finally, we had a big fight, and I said, okay, we record that song. I went and wrote some new lyrics to it, and we sat down and we worked it out, and put it out, and it became a smash hit right away. But she has a nose or an ear for what's popular, though. She made the very first rap records by just listening to the kids in the street. She said that could be great on a record, you know. So, but they made a pile of money with that rap, those first rap records. In fact, if you got rap music today, it's because of Sylvia.
So you went to France to get away from the whole Mickey and Sylvia thing?
Oh, Mickey and Sylvia was not the only thing. I was fed up with lots of things, you know. First place, let's put it this way. When I was a little boy, I always wanted to go to France simply because I heard that Josephine Baker was in New York, in Paris, and she was raging a storm, you know. I said, one of these days, I'm going to go to Paris, and I'm going to do the same thing. I was 11 and a half years old, and all of a sudden, one day, I dude it.
<You know>? Now, I have a question for you about your childhood. I know that you spent a good deal of your childhood in orphan homes and reform schools, yes?
No, not so much reform school. Well, it was off. Let us say that it was an orphan home to keep kids from going to the reform school later on.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because that's exactly where I would have wound up.
And you kept running away. did they keep bringing you back when you'd run away?
Yeah, they bring me back all the time. I ran away and went to New York one time, and they came up and brought me back, and I went to Chicago, and they brought me back, and I went to St. Louis. Well, you see, I went to St. Louis because I said, that's where the blues was created. I had this imagination, this fantastic imagination, you know. I said, I want to go to St. Louis, for instance, because that's where the St. Louis blues was written. I got the St. Louis blues, all I could see was shoe factories. You know? No blues at all. And next time I said, I'm going to Chicago, it's all those gangsters, you know. And then the next time I said, I'm going to New York, so I'm going to go to New York and I'm going to take a hop of, I'm going to become a merchant seaman and take a boat to France, and then I'm going to become French.
So tell me, was having freights and hitchhiking as a kid alone
not
on the road?
Darling,
not hitchhiking? No.
I'd just get on freight trains and go. Uh-huh. So in those days, it was possible, you know. You could get a, you know, when you go to a hobo camp, they call them hobos, you know. You go to a hobo camp, and, you, and the guy says, well, you say, well, I want to go to Pittsburgh. He says, well, there's a certain train that will come out of the yard, because you couldn't go in the yard, but you could wait outside the yard to catch the train. And the hobos would always be there. They didn't do too much about it. They used to beat them up and knock them off of trains, but they couldn't get rid of them. Hobos are not bums, you know. They weren't bums. They were just people that would like to go from one place to another, free, on freight trains, you know?
And let me ask you, since you've been on hundreds of recording sessions, do you ever hear a record getting played on the radio and think to yourself, is that me? I can't remember if that's me or not.
Not really. I knew how ridiculous I was on the guitar. I can hear some people and I'd say, damn, it sounds like me, you know. But then he'll do something else in the course of what he's doing that I know that I don't do. I didn't do. It could be much better than what I did, you know, but I know right away that it's not me, you know.
Well, Mickey Baker, I want to congratulate you on your Rhythm and Blues Foundation Award, and have a good visit to the United States before you return to your home in France.
Right.
Want to say a few words for us in French before you go?
C'était très bien passé, mais malheureusement, c'est fini. Au revoir.
Au revoir. Mickey Baker will receive a Pioneer Award tonight from the Rhythm and Blues Foundation at their 10th annual award ceremony. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Sylvia!
Yes, Mickey?
How you call your lover boy?
Come here, lover boy.
And if he doesn't answer?
Oh, lover boy.
And if he still doesn't answer?
I simply say, baby.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, what if most of the characters in the Old Testament were gay? We talk with writer Paul Rudnick about his new play, The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told. Also, David Bianculli previews NBC's Alice in Wonderland, and Lloyd Schwartz reviews art shows by two 17th century painters. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sunday night, NBC presents Alice in Wonderland, a new live-action TV version of the Lewis Carroll classic. TV critic David Bianculli has seen this new Alice and says it's wonderful.
It's taken more than 100 years, but technology finally has caught up with Lewis Carroll. This new NBC Alice in Wonderland, using the latest computer graphic effects and state-of-the-art puppeteering, actually manages to recreate, in three dimensions, most of the reality-bending craziness of Carroll's original stories and John Tenniel's memorable illustrations. When college professor Charles L. Dodgson, under the pen name Lewis Carroll, published his first Alice book, the Civil War had just ended. Alice's Adventures in Wonderland came out in 1865, followed by a sequel, Through the Looking Glass and What Alice Found There, in 1871. Around the turn of the century, the motion picture was invented, and Alice inspired one of the first silent movies aimed at children. Now we're nearing the turn of another century, and this time, everything Carol imagined actually can be duplicated with special effects. Alice can play croquet using a flamingo as a mallet and somehow have it look real. A squealing baby can turn into a pig with no warning, and the Mad Hatter, played with giddy enthusiasm by Martin Short, really can sport a head three times as large as it ought to be. Peter Barnes, who also wrote NBC's Merlin miniseries, has adapted the two Alice books by faithfully dramatizing the former and borrowing selected characters and scenes from the latter. He also adds an original beginning and ending about Alice having to give a musical recital, which introduces all the actors out of costume, and, in terms of structure, is a nice little nod to The Wizard of Oz. The only really regrettable omission in this TV version is that of the Jabberwocky poem from the second book. It should have been included, especially since so much of Carol's other poetry made the cut. This new Alice is so enchanting, though, that not even that oversight, nor its other flaw, the unimaginative music by Richard Hartley, can rob this NBC treat of its 4-star rating. Director Nick Willing, working with visual effects supervisor David Booth, production designer Roger Hall, and Jim Henson's Creature Shop, has created the ideal world in which prim young Alice finds herself. Alice is played by Tina Majorino from the movies Andre and Waterworld, and she's surrounded by sparkling talents. Especially delightful are Short as the Mad Hatter, Miranda Richardson as the Queen of Hearts, and Christopher Lloyd as the White Knight. There's also Peter Ustinov as the Walrus, Gene Wilder as the Mock Turtle, Whoopi Goldberg as the Cheshire Cat, and Robbie Coltrane and George Wendt as Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Listen to how much fun Miranda Richardson has as the Queen, halting her entourage to meet Alice for the first time.
And who is this?
I agree entirely.
Don't be ridiculous.
Would I lie to you, Your Majesty?
Yes.
Oh, well, thank you. Compliments are always welcome.
You're an idiot.
That's right, Your Majesty. Only you could spot that. It takes one to know one.
A complete idiot. Your name, child?
Alice. If it please Your Majesty.
I be stopped.
And who are these?
How should I know? I'm a stranger here.
Off with her head!
Off with her head!
Off with her head!
Stop losing your temper. It's vulgar.
Consider, my dears, he's just a child.
You think so?
Yes, I would account for it. Children have no respect for their betters these days.
NBC's Alice, like the original book, embraces both logic and absurdity with equal fervor and captures a dreamlike feeling in ways unlikely to be forgotten. If you stay long enough to fall down the rabbit hole with Alice, you'll know by then you're in for a truly special TV journey.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, what if God really did make Adam and Steve? This is Fresh Air. How many times have you heard this reproach of homosexuality? God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. Well, in Paul Rudnick's latest play, The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told, it's Adam and Steve who find themselves in the Garden of Eden. Screenwriter and playwright Paul Rudnick has satirized life from a gay point of view in Jeffrey and In and Out. He also wrote the screenplay for Adam's Family Values and writes a satirical film criticism column in Premiere Magazine under the pen name Libby Gelman Waxner. The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told is now running off-Broadway. I asked Rudnick if he ever came up with a witty retort in response to someone saying that God didn't make Adam and Steve.
Well, I came up with a play. I thought, why not take these people at their hard-hearted words, sort of spin it, and see what would happen if God had indeed made Adam and Steve and the first two lesbians, Jane and Mabel, as well, to really take that as the basis for an entire New Testament. And it ended up being a wonderful amount of fun.
What are some of the differences between the two couples?
The two couples, well, it's funny. I think they go through, it's more a question of similarities, I think. I think the couples go through what, I wanted it to keep it as universal as possible, because they go through what every couple, gay and straight, go through. At one point, they're all captive on the Ark, where it's pouring, and they're surrounded by animals, and they've all been together for 400 years. So, of course, they pretty much have run out of things to say. And I think that happens to almost every couple. Sometimes it doesn't take 400 years, but suddenly they're, while still desperately in love, also at each other's throats. They're going through all those stages of romantic development. That's something else I wanted to investigate in the play, is to use the whole story of the Old Testament also as a romantic journey.
Of course, at least one of the people is having sex with animals on the Ark.
Yes, well, that's one of the interesting developments when you begin in a gay-run universe, is that people don't tend to reproduce quite as rapidly. So we remain, the planet has just those initial two couples for quite a few millennia. So the only romantic options after a certain point are all the rhinoceri and cats and pigs on the Ark. And because it's a very open and loving universe, it becomes kind of a great mixer.
Have you gotten any protests from religious groups to your script?
Well, it's funny, not quite so many. There have been a few. There's a group that is very dedicated to a defense of Our Lady of Fatima and whatever miracle occurred at Fatima. And so they, for a while, did kind of bombard the New York Theater Workshop with phone messages and letters, mostly asking, why couldn't Paul Rudnick write a play about Our Lady of Fatima? And I kept thinking, do they really want me to? You know, I thought it was an interesting question on both sides. But what I would hope is that anyone who worries about the play, who imagines objections, would actually go to see it. What I found most disturbing about a lot of the furor that surrounded Terrence McNally's play, Corpus Christi, was that erupted from sources that had no real contact with the play. They had neither seen it nor read a script. And I think you only get a more intelligent and human dialogue about any work of art when both sides have witnessed it, have gone through it, have read it or seen it.
The Pharaoh has a nice part in your play. And would you do for us a couple of the lines in which he's talking about the building of the pyramids?
Well, the Pharaoh is a role that I wrote for just a superb actor named Peter Bartlett, who's appeared in other of my plays and films. So I will only be able to do the most tepid impression of his genius. But he does play an extremely madcap and empowered Pharaoh. And at one point, he looks out into the audience where he envisions his empire, and he says, I have enslaved hundreds of thousands of homosexuals to build my pyramids. Oh, look at them all just sitting there, criticizing. Why can't we build a beach house? Get to work! No, he's that kind of pharaoh.
And then, how about the line where he's telling all the slaves to sing as they work?
Oh, yes. After there's been a kind of Spartacus-like slave uprising led by Adam, the pharaoh turns to one of his beloved Amazon guards, Fatatatita, and says, let them go. Let them all go. I am the boy king of all Egypt. I am immortal. Sing, gay slaves. Sing as you toil. Sing a gay slave song. And Fatatatita says, sing to your pharaoh. And then the song that the gay slaves pipe right back is from chorus line, which I think is the equivalent of some sort of gay work hand gospel.
That's great. Did you go back and watch the Ten Commandments to get a sense of Hollywood biblical speak?
Yes, well, it had been pretty much ingrained that I grew up on all that sort of pop culture Bible. And that was also where the idea for the play came from, that sense of, oh, the Prince of, you know, the new DreamWorks Prince of Egypt, the DeMille films about the Ten Commandments and the life of Christ, that whole homogenized, weirdly American version of the Bible in which everyone speaks English. And usually the bad guys, the pharaohs, tend to have some sort of foreign accents, usually British. But the good guys, Charlton Heston, and are always Americans and always seem like quarterbacks or chess club presidents. So it's a very strange and parochial view of the history of faith, but that's why it was also very funny.
Now, the way you describe the pharaoh in your play, you say the atmosphere might suggest Egypt by way of the MGM Luxor Hotel in Las Vegas. The pharaoh wears a striped headdress and flowing robes reminiscent of the blindingly golden attire of Tutankhamun. You know, I'm thinking a lot of those gay epics, they seem so... did I say gay epics? A lot of those biblical epics seem so gay in retrospect, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no inspiration for a drag queen like, you know, a decent pharaoh. I mean, those guys knew how to dress. I think they had the eye makeup, you know? I think everyone from Ramses to Cleopatra, they seemed distinctly Ziegfeld to me.
Did you have a sense of that when you were young watching the biblical epics, that there seemed to be just something gay about the movies?
Oh, I think so, or at least something wildly and welcomely absurd, which isn't the same thing as gay, but it's certainly a friendly neighbor. There certainly was something very homoerotic about that whole set of Hercules and Gladiator.
That's
and
the word
Ten
I was looking for.
Films.
Yes, that's right.
Oh yeah, that's where you get, yeah, you know, Yul Brynner in shirtless in a tight tennis skirt, you know, with a few golden armbands around his rather impressive biceps. So there's a famous scene from
Spartacus.
Spartacus, yes, where I believe Tony Curtis is bathing Laurence Olivier, and the dialogue is fairly coded, but it's an extremely homoerotic scene. So I think, my God, those cultures certainly were enormously open to all sorts of sexual possibilities.
Did you grow up with any Bible stories?
Let me think. I grew up in a violently Reform Jewish home. So what I had were odd forms of biblical kitsch. I had a wristwatch that had a map of Israel on it, and instead of numerals, it had Hebrew letters. I also had a book that I really cherished that was made up of invented biblical headlines. It was printed on newsprint, and it said things like, David slays giant, read all about it. So it was the Bible translated into Gotham City terms, pretty much. Within my family, we were too Jewish to have a Christmas tree, but we were not quite Jewish enough to really celebrate every night of Hanukkah or to go over the Bible in any great detail. I remember at our yearly Passover Seders, sometimes there'd be an uncle who would really want to go through the whole story in Hebrew and recite every possible plague. And the rest of us would sit at the other end of the table, you know, asking, when do we eat? And tossing our yarmulkes around. So it wasn't really a particularly devout home.
Now tell me what you do when you're in the audience and you're trying to monitor the audience's reaction. Do you actually count laughs or count the amount of time that elapses between laughs?
Oh, I'm far cheaper than that. No, I have this. It's this one of my deepest neuroses is I somehow imagine that the audience's response is directly attached to my central nervous system. So unless I stay incredibly tense, they will stop laughing. I also tend to make very Baroque deals with God, where I say if you allow the audience to laugh at the next line, you could take my right hand. And then if they laugh, I immediately rescind the bargain and move on to another body part. So hopefully by the end of each evening, I've just been reduced to, you know, a helpless torso. So lately I've been trying, this can get a little stressful. So I've been trying to relax. And what I found is that now I can really enjoy the play. Because I take such delight in this production, which was directed by Chris Ashley, who's directed almost all my work, and this cast that I adore them.
Your latest play, The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told, takes up the premise, what if God made Adam and Steve instead of Adam and Eve? I'm wondering if you've ended up thinking very seriously about religion as well over the past few years. I guess what I'm really asking here is I know that you've had a lot of, or I assume that you've had a lot of friends who've died of AIDS over the years, and that's the kind of thing that provokes a lot of people to examine or re-examine their thoughts about the role of religion in their life or any approach to spirituality. Some people find themselves drifting closer to it. Other people further away because they're so angry. For some people, they could find meaning through secular pursuits and don't feel the need to turn toward religion. And if you don't mind a serious question here, I'm wondering if the last few years have changed at all your sense of the need or not for religion in your life.
Oh, absolutely. It's funny. That's one of the reasons why I wrote this play. I wanted to force myself to examine those issues quite seriously. And it's something that goes beyond even the questions of gay or straight or the comedy of the play, that I wanted to see why God is still such a provocative flashpoint for all of us, and to see what I thought, what I ultimately made of matters of faith. So it's been a real, oh my God, a continuing exploration. And it's funny, it's why often people now come up to me and say, Paul, do you believe in God? And it still could be a very uncomfortable question. It's why, it was one of the reasons why I wrote the play. I thought, you know, sexual matters have become so commonplace that in many ways religion and God have become this final taboo. And I wanted to explore that. And I think for personal conclusions, the most I've come up with, at least at this point, is I find genuine transcendence and a sense of the spiritual in my work in the theater, especially, and in film as well, but mostly in that intense collaboration with other people leading to, hopefully, God willing, the delight of an audience, that sense of a group creating something larger than themselves, of a communal good. And I think that also was mirrored in my experience with so many friends who've been sick and who died from AIDS, and working with people in the gay community and the friends of that community in New York especially. The truest religion seems to be the faith that you invent or accumulate on your own, and that can certainly involve enormous pieces or even entire manuscripts from traditional religions, but it's got to come from you or from me. It's got to be a decision that I come to, a morality that I can accept and try to adhere to. That's what makes the most bedrock sense, and that's something I can live with day to day. Somehow, if I'm always referring to someone else's text, to someone's Bible, to someone's Quran, then I feel like, my God, I've just been given a manual and I'm not quite sure if it's all going to work. But if I can go into a theater and see people of such enormous talent and such enormous generosity and work with them and then, you know, present something to the rest of the world and make them laugh, that's almost all the God I need.
Now, how do you deal with the fact that when you're actually at the theater, you're there making bargains with God, like you were saying earlier, that if they laugh at this line, God, you could take my right hand?
Well, that
I mean, old habits die hard, huh?
That's what I would refer to as insanity, which is my other personal gospel. Yes. Oh, no. When you want to laugh, all bets are off. I'm sorry. Human sacrifice would be an easy price to pay for a decent chuckle. You know, I have no problem with that. If the Muslims will laugh at me, I will, you know, head out after Salman Rushdie. You know, I think laughter it can also be a little bit amoral. There's that real, oh my God, deep inner laugh lust, and that pretty much conquers everything.
Paul Rudnick, his play The Most Fabulous Story Ever Told, is now running off-Broadway. Coming up, two shows of 17th century painters. This is Fresh Air.
Every little step she takes. One thrilling combination. Every move that she makes. One smile and suddenly nobody else will do. You know you'll never be lonely with you. No.
It's art, not music, that's been on classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz's mind this week. He's been to two shows of important 17th century painters, one Dutch, one Italian, and finds some unexpected similarities.
I've been haunted by two recent painting exhibits, very different from one another, yet both somehow underline the strange paradoxes of art and the artistic life. The Wadsworth Athenaeum in Hartford, Connecticut, the oldest public museum in America, has been playing co-host, along with London's Dulwich Picture Gallery, to the very first exhibition of paintings devoted to the 17th century minor Dutch master Pieter de Hooch. You might recognize his paintings even if you didn't remember his name. The touching interiors and courtyards of Dutch houses, everyday scenes of domestic tranquility, mothers and children, maidservants cleaning, doing the shopping, or serving drinks. The rooms are aglow with sunlight filtering in from open doorways or overhead windows. Sunny courtyards are paved with meticulous brickwork. De Hooch's father was a bricklayer. Delft's noble church tower rises just beyond a garden wall. I love the painting from Amsterdam's Rijksmuseum of the woman devoting her tenderest concentration on removing the lice from her child's head, which is nestled in her lap. Later in his career, de Hooch moved to Amsterdam and painted wealthier families, and these paintings have an almost creepy chill to them. Still, they didn't prepare me for learning that de Hooch died in poverty in a mental institution at the age of 55. How could the artist who created those scenes of calm and caring and comfort, such archetypal images of sanity, have ended so badly? De Hooch's small-scale middle-class domesticity couldn't be further from the glamour and grandeur of the great Italian artist Michelangelo Caravaggio, who died less than two decades before de Hooch was born. The highlight of a fascinating exhibit at the McMullen Museum at Boston College of 16th and 17th century Italian Baroque painting is Caravaggio's The Taking of Christ, a painting which for 200 years was thought to be irrevocably lost. In 1990, it was rediscovered in a Jesuit residence in Dublin. Now cleaned and restored, it's housed in the National Gallery of Ireland. Through the Jesuit network, it's making its first appearance in the Western Hemisphere. It's an astounding and complex painting. Judas has just given Jesus the kiss that betrays him to the Roman guards. In Caravaggio's famous chiaroscuro, light and dark in dramatic contrast, you have to sort your way through a wreath of intertwining arms, Judas's and the soldiers, which are hard to attach to the right bodies. In the crowd at the extreme right, a handsome young man holds up a lantern. It's Caravaggio, painting himself doing what every artist tries to do, searching for some meaning, shedding some light in the darkness and confusion. At the heart of the painting are the heartbreaking, heartbroken faces of Judas and Jesus, faces that in this intimate closeness could be the faces of lovers. Which one is sadder? Jesus seems helplessly resigned to all the implications of what has occurred. His expression is one of the most tragic I've ever seen. Caravaggio was a sensualist. His figures, biblical or mythical, especially the young men, are extravagantly beautiful. The textures of their clothes are gorgeous, even the rags, and you can feel the flesh under their garments. In the brilliant pockets of light, you can make out even the dirt under their fingernails. In the taking of Christ, Caravaggio seems to get under their skin as well, inside their souls. The spiritual and the erotic, even the homoerotic, are impossible to separate. He too ended badly. He was an adventurer, maybe a thug. He murdered someone over a bet. And though he was protected by the most powerful forces in the church, he died mysteriously, probably trying to escape from assassins, a few weeks before his 39th birthday. It doesn't make sense. The insanity lurking beneath de Hoogh's comforting complacency, the carnality that embodies Caravaggio's spiritual illumination. Could either one of them have produced their best work without these underlying self-destructive forces? We work in the dark, says the dying author in Henry James's story, The Middle Years. We do what we can. We give what we have. Our doubt is our passion, and our passion is our task. The rest is the madness of art.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Peter de Hoogh at the Wadsworth Athenaeum in Hartford through March 14th and a Caravaggio exhibit at Boston College through May 24th. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Chris Fraley is our engineer. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Pantheon Books, publisher of Anne Lamott's latest book, Traveling Mercies, Some Thoughts on Faith, available in bookstores. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, Isaac Hayes, one of this year's recipients of a Rhythm and Blues Foundation Award. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.